You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of May, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Poppy Trowbridge.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Monocle's Asia Editor-at-Large, Kenji Hall, joins us to set the day's agenda. What do you have for us today, Kenji?
We'll be talking about Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's latest diplomatic push in Asia.
We also head to Beirut to find out what rockets launched against a Shiite Muslim district signifies for the war in Syria and Lebanon's stability.
And why giving money away is good for you.
We are wired this way, that of course we need to be competitive, but we also need to be altruistic. I'm saying giving is good for you because it makes you feel good.
We also talk elections, property tax, and ask what lies ahead for Fiat with our man in Milan.
And we'll head to Art Athena Fair to explore Greece's art scene following its economic crisis.
Everyone who works and lives in Athens and is an artist has a radar for all the social and political changes that happen before our eyes.
All that, plus we play some music too in the next hour here on Midori House.
But before all that, let's catch up on the latest world news headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Three men arrested in connection with last week's murder of a British soldier in southeast London have been released on bail. The men, all in their 20s, were arrested on Saturday on suspicion of conspiracy to murder. Three men, including the two prime suspects, remain in custody. The head of British counter-terrorism operations says police are following a significant amount of lines of inquiry into drummer Lee Rigby's murder. On Sunday, Kenyan police said they detained one of the two men suspected of the murder in 2010 on suspicion of seeking to train with an Al-Qaeda-linked group in Somalia. Deputy Assistant Commissioner Stuart Osborne, the senior national coordinator of counter-terrorism.
The Metropolitan Police Counter-Terrorism Command, supported by the National Counter-Terrorism Officers and the Security Service, continue to work tirelessly and painstakingly to uncover the full circumstances relating to this attack. We are pursuing a significant amount of CCTV, social media, forensic and intelligence opportunities and have active lines of inquiry. The two men arrested at the scene of the attack remain in hospital and will be formally interviewed when it is possible to do so.
The Syrian opposition group, the Syrian National Council, has agreed in principle to attend peace talks in Geneva planned for June, but it says it still believes the Syrian government has little intention of taking them seriously. The statement followed the announcement from Syria's foreign minister that the government would take part in the talks. But Syria's main opposition coalition has said it will only take part if President Assad steps down. Luay Safi is a Syrian National Coalition member.
The Assad regime has to make it clear that they are there to engage in talk about transition to democracy as part of Geneva understanding, that would mean that all the powers that reside today with Bashar al-Assad will be given to the transitional government, and this point is still not clear.
The Colombian government and FARC rebels, who are currently engaged in lengthy peace negotiations in Cuba, have reached agreement on land reform. They said the accord called for the economic and social development of rural areas and providing land to the people living there. This had been one of the key issues which led to FARC being founded in 1964. The government's chief negotiator said the agreement would represent a historic change, a rebirth of the Colombian countryside. But he added that it would only take effect when an overall peace deal is reached. The peace talks will resume in Havana on June the 11th. A memorial service has been held in honour of the victims of last week's tornado in Oklahoma City, which killed 24 people and injured nearly 400 others. Among those addressing the service was first grade music teacher Wayne L. Mays, who was trapped inside a classroom with her pupils after the tornado hit the school building.
I said, now, when a hero comes, we got to use our musical instruments and you got to bang really hard because we want them to get us out of here. And I just kept telling them how proud I was of them because they had listened and they had followed directions and we were here. And then someone said hello, and they started banging the desk and calling, "We're here, we're here," in the loudest voices you had ever heard.
Several hundred French police have charged into about 200 demonstrators after 2 hours of street battles in Paris at the end of a major protest against gay marriage legislation. Police estimate that the demonstration was attended by around 150,000 people. Eyewitnesses said numerous arrests were made as large amounts of tear gas were fired. Legislation clearing the way for same-sex unions cleared its final hurdle early this month, and the first gay marriage is due to take place in southern France next week. An emotional lesbian love story by the French director Abdellatif Kechiche has won the top prize at the 2013 Cannes Film Festival. La vie d'Adèle, chapitre 1 et 2, Blue is the warmest colour being the English title, was chosen from a field of 20 films vying for the Palme d'Or. Thierry Frémaux, the festival's artistic director, was delighted to see the top prize going to a film addressing such a topical issue.
I love the idea of having a big fight in France right now about what we call the mariage pour tous, the marriage for everyone, to have a film talking about a love passion between two people of the same sex. And that film was conceived and made 2 years ago. So the artists are always, you know, writing the future.
Those are the main stories here on Monaco 24.
Thanks, Barney. It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Midori House on Monaco 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. It's time now to set the day's news agenda with the day's big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us from our Tokyo bureau today is Monocle's Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall. Welcome to the program, Kenji. Shinzo Abe has been meeting quite a few world leaders as of late, it seems.
Yes, that's right. The latest one he's meeting is Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, who is in Japan for 4 days. On a diplomatic mission. Their first meeting will be today. The two will be discussing, or are expected to be discussing, the likely restart of talks for a bilateral agreement on energy, specifically nuclear energy. India has plans to spend about $1 trillion U.S. dollars in infrastructure over the next 5 years. This would include new nuclear power plants. Currently, India has about 20 and has plans to build 18 more by 2020. Another possible item on the agenda would be a high-speed rail link between Mumbai and Ahmedabad. Currently, Japan is proposing that a consortium of Japanese companies, these would be companies like JR East and Nippon Shadyo, Kawasaki Heavy, provide technology and know-how for Japanese trains and operating systems. This would be the first time that Japanese companies have provided such a comprehensive transportation package, and it would be a leap forward for Japan's efforts to export its train technology. I
mean, Kenji, it makes sense that everyone wants to get a bite of that $1 trillion, but it, like you said there, it's just as much about a reviving faith and belief and optimism in Japan's ability to export. I mean, is this Abenomics, as they're calling it, is it working? Is everybody getting behind it, feeling a bit more gung-ho about economic prospects for Japan?
Well, I think you make a good point, because Abe has taken on the role as Japan's salesman in chief for Japanese industry in a way that past prime ministers had not. Obviously, Abe would like to see these deals and all these sort of diplomatic trips leading to something of more contracts for Japanese companies overseas, more exports. But at this point, you know, it's still hard to judge when these things will actually move forward.
And let's, Kenji, just discuss the nuclear option there. Many people, the Japanese really pushing that, selling that to India. But India's actually put a stop to further nuclear testing in the country there. What is Japan actually doing to guarantee that these sales will go through?
That's a good question because, you know, there's something of a contradiction here. Japan has about 50 nuclear reactors. Only two of them are operating. The rest are offline for safety reasons and for safety inspection checks. At the same time, it's pushing hard to promote technology from the likes of Hitachi and Toshiba, which produce these reactors. So, you know, it's hard to say at this point whether Japan will succeed in making the argument that, you know, its nuclear technology is safe and should be adopted.
How much of this, Kenji, is just words, not action? I mean, is trade between India and Japan growing? Can you put that into context for us?
Sure. Back in 2011, the trade figure was at about $17.8 billion. The two have a target of about $25 billion by 2014. They signed an FTA back in 2011, which eliminates tariffs on most trades, most goods traded between the two sides. So you're seeing a lot of really aggressive progress between, you know, and a push for these two countries to increase their interaction.
There seems to be a lot of goodwill there, and I'm imagining an India with high-speed rail all across the country. I mean, but can they afford it?
Yeah, it's a good question. At this point, you know, those are the sorts of logistics that have to be worked out. This specific high-speed rail link between Mumbai and Ahmedabad would cost about 8 billion euros. That's a huge amount of money. At the same time, you know, it's 500 kilometers, so it would the trip currently takes about 6.5 hours. It would reduce that trip to about 2 hours. It would be a huge leap for businessmen and women traveling between those two cities. And, you know, to be honest with you, I think India does need this kind of technology.
And Shinzo Abe also just met up with the Burmese president, Thein Sein. What can you tell us about that visit?
That's right. Abe is just back from what many analysts are calling a landmark visit to Burma over the weekend, where he met with the Burmese president, Thein Sein. It was the first time a Japanese prime minister had visited Burma in 36 years, hence the landmark that everyone's attaching to the visit. The two met in Naypyidaw, and Abe announced that Japan would write off nearly $2 billion in outstanding debt. This comes after Tokyo forgave about $4 billion in debt, a development that was announced back in January. Tokyo also pledged about $500 million U.S. dollars in aid and technical assistance for things like power generation projects. Obviously, again, Abe is trying to gain privileged access to a new market. Burma's market has become more open as of late.
I think you might be getting to it there. How much of this, though, is also driven by that constant motive in the background, the rivalry between Japan and China?
Oh, absolutely. You read my mind. You know, China is a huge, huge thing in the back of everyone's mind here in Tokyo. Abe obviously wants to beef up Tokyo's diplomatic presence in the region, and it's strategic, as you mentioned, countering China's growing influence in the region. China does have a jump on Japan. China is the largest of Burma's investors, with about $4 billion in aid and investments. But Japan, you know, there are differences in the way that Japan and China are approaching investment to Burma. Japan's eager to tap into Burma's cheap labor force and broaden its network of factories. So these would bring jobs to local Burmese. At the same time, China is more focused on sort of getting at Burma's natural resources like natural gas and gems and timber and rubber. And so, you know, many see Japan's sort of approach as a lot less threatening. And, you know, it seems Japan could make some serious progress here.
Thanks, Kenji. I think we'll have to leave it there. That was Kenji Hall, Asia editor for Monocle, joining us on the line from Tokyo.
Coming up, we explore the heightened sectarian tensions in Lebanon following yesterday's rocket strikes in Beirut.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
When it comes to retail, the Taiwanese capital's independent shops are increasingly worthy of attention. Monocle's filmmaker wandered down side streets to discover a myriad of new small shops, each with a concept totally their own.
The name for the Pinmo Pure Store came to founder Richard Wong in a dream. It, too, is a hybrid, a tiny space on a residential street in the Daan district that carries paper goods and clothing. A design agency shares the space, and tea and cookies are available even though there's no space to sit down.
Changing the city's retail landscape, one little shop at a time. Taipei Retail, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Now on Sunday, a rocket strike hit a Shiite Muslim district of Beirut. The attack came after Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah vowed on Saturday to fight until victory, reinforcing his support for Assad's regime. It is the first time an attack to apparently target Hezbollah's stronghold in southern Beirut since the start of the two-year conflict in Syria.
And in his speech on Saturday, the Hezbollah leader discouraged Lebanese from fighting one another, telling them to instead go and fight in Syria. Nasrallah's comments come a week after a major Syrian army and Hezbollah offensive in Qasair, a rebel stronghold. It's about 10 kilometers from the Lebanese border. The conflict in neighboring Syria has heightened sectarian tensions in Lebanon. And to discuss all of this, the current situation included, we're joined on the line by Fawaz Zerzez. He's director of Middle East Center at the London School of Economics. Good morning and welcome to you, Fawaz. I think the first things first here, Phil and I were talking about this story. Has anyone claimed responsibility? Are any fingers being pointed yet in one clear direction or another?
No, I don't think anyone knows.
Doesn't that just add to the confusion here? What can you take away from this attack if we don't know who perpetrated it?
Well, I mean, what we need to understand is that the attack basically was designed to send a clear message to Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, who made it very clear that the party of Hezbollah is deeply now engaged in the fighting inside Syria. And I think also part of the message is to provoke the Shiite-dominated party in Lebanon to retaliate. Because remember, what we need to understand is that Lebanon is deeply polarized along both sectarian and ideological lines. Hezbollah is basically fighting on the part of Syria, and you have also a large number of Lebanese, in particular Sunni Lebanese, who are supporting the armed opposition. So in this particular sense, it does not really take an expert to realize that the message was sent by the anti-Assad elements, by the Lebanese, some of the Lebanese elements who believe that Hezbollah has taken side against the armed opposition inside Syria.
How dangerous is this, Fawaz, that this is really the start of the spillover from Syria and this is the real beginning of a regional conflict that will engulf many more countries than just Syria itself?
Well, you know, this is not the first time that basically an attack takes place inside Lebanon. This is the first time that an attack has taken place against the Hezbollah's basically social part of support inside Beirut itself. The conflict in Syria has already spread into neighboring countries, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, and Turkey. You have armed clashes in Lebanon on a daily basis. In the last 1 week, almost 25 Lebanese have been killed, hundreds injured, in the second largest city in Lebanon. It's called Tripoli, bordering Syria. I mean, you have, it's a battlefield. Also in Sidon, another major city in Lebanon, in the Bekaa Valley. The question is not really whether the conflict in Syria will spill over into Lebanon. The question is, will the limited armed clashes in Lebanon escalate into all-out sectarian war in Lebanon? This is really what are we talking about. Lebanon is in the eye of the storm. And as you said in your question, the last element of your question, in fact, the Syrian conflict is no longer an internal conflict. It's an open-ended, war by proxy, and there's a real danger that the entire region could explode into a bigger clash as a result of the conflict inside Syria.
And Fawaz, then, what danger to these proposed peace talks coming up next month, then?
Well, I mean, I think this is another great question, because the reason why the Americans and the Russians now basically insist on holding the conference in Geneva at the end of next month, they appreciate the complexity and the gravity of the crisis in Syria. It's no longer just the opposition versus Assad. You have Israel now, you have Turkey, you have Saudi Arabia, you have Qatar, you have Hezbollah, you have Iran. I mean, think of the mix. Think of the, I mean, potential for a huge, huge escalation. And I think even though the conference, the proposed peace conference in Geneva, faces daunting challenges, I would argue it's the only light at the end of the tunnel. And the Americans and the Russians are pushing very hard, both the anti- and the pro-Assad elements, in order to prevent the escalation of the Syrian conflict into a region-wide conflict.
And indeed, you mentioned many of those groups there. Another one, on Sunday, yesterday, Egyptian jihadist movements called on the Mujahideen to go to Lebanon and fight Hezbollah. How likely of a scenario do you think that will be?
Well, it's not likely. It has happened. The reality is, in Syria now, you have between 6,000 and 10,000 foreign fighters fighting the Assad regime. In fact, to be fair to Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, in his speech, he said, look, you talk about Hezbollah's involvement in the conflict, in which he really took responsibility. He said, we have intervened in Syria after almost 10,000 foreign fighters, 6,000 or 7,000 of whom are jihadists. They subscribe to jihadist ideologies. But beyond the rhetoric, what you have now in Syria is really a very complex conflict, multiple conflicts in one. Foreign jihadists, political struggle, regional geopolitics and geostrategic conflict, not to mention international rivalry between Russia and the United States. This tells you about this terrible, dangerous mix that's taken place inside Syria in the last 2 years.
One of the questions that I can't get out of my mind is, how can the Syrian opposition, Fawaz, afford to spread themselves this thin? Won't that just hasten their defeat or dispersion at least?
I really think now this is really the sad and painful question really to discuss. I mean, I am very reluctant to really criticize the opposition, because whenever I say a mild word, I mean, it pains me, because we want the pro-democracy elements to succeed. The reality is, the opposition now is in a terrible bind. It has no coherence, it has no independence, it has no charismatic leadership, it's dependent on regional powers, it finds itself in a terrible bind, pressed between its high ambitions and aspirations to get rid of Assad. Yet the reality on the ground, the balance of power, the infighting among the regional powers, the Syrian opposition now basically, I mean, look, they've been meeting for 4 days in Istanbul. They have not been able to put their house in order, because regional powers now really hold the key to whatever decision they take. And this tells you about how conflicts start and how conflicts mutate and how difficult now to achieve a military victory or even a military solution inside Syria. One final point. There is no military solution to the conflict in Syria. Neither Assad nor the opposition can win this conflict militarily. Only politics, only a political solution can rescue Syria from total, complete destruction.
A difficult situation indeed. That was Fawaz Jerjes, director of the Middle East Center at the London School of Economics. Many thanks.
Now Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, two of the world's most famously wealthy men, both not only pledge but also actively campaign to get others to join them in giving away at least half their fortunes to charity.
Indeed, the U.S. has quite the culture of philanthropy. Over here in the U.K., however, inequality is on the rise, and one author is calling on Britain's government and wealthier sections of society to give more of their money and time to good causes.
John Nixon is the author of Giving is Good for You, Why Britain Should Be Bothered and Give More, which is published on the 6th of June. He shared some of his arguments with Monocle's Marcus Hippy.
John Nixon, you are one of the UK's most successful fundraisers with a career of 30 years or so. What made you want to write this book now?
Because of the state of the world now, we're in a mess internationally, certainly in the Western economies. Private sectors hit the buffers, public sectors hit the buffers, and we're only now aware of the growing inequality in the world, and particularly in this country, and only now are we, although it's been growing for 30 years, are we beginning to become aware that it's a problem?
And why does equality matter in the long run?
Well, we now have research that tells us that the more unequal societies are the most dysfunctional in terms of ill health, violence, and crime. For example, the United States, which must be one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest country in the world, has a life in the life expectancy tables comes at a very low 28th, with very high levels of crime. So inequality costs. You could say it's adding to public expenditure. So we need to take that seriously. It affects all levels of society, including the middle classes.
The title of your book is Giving is Good for You, Why Britain Should Be Bothered and Give More. And when I was reading this book, I started thinking about so many people I know who are actually struggling with their mortgages. And people don't always have that much money to give. Are you actually saying that we all should still donate more?
In Britain, just over half the population are giving, but many more, possibly nearer 70%, are giving their time. So we are charitably minded. Of course, the times are testing. For ordinary people, life is more expensive. It costs more to bring up children and look after your elderly parents. So in the first instance, I'm looking at the most wealthy because they don't have any excuses.
You already said that social class determines sometimes how much you donate, but are there cultural differences? Are there regions in the world where people simply give more?
Well, it depends how you count it. We don't want to get bogged down in figures, but as a percentage of our national income, Britain does very well. So we come second. We're giving over 1% of our GDP, but that's much less than the US, who are giving 2% of their GDP. But if you look at the numbers of people who are giving to charity in other countries, we don't do so well. We're number 8. We come in after, and here's the list: Australia, Ireland, Canada, New Zealand, the United States, the Netherlands, and Indonesia. Not quite so good.
I'm thinking, being from one of the Nordic countries, I'm thinking about the model over there. Quite often people up there in the north think that because they pay so much taxes, everything is dealt with the tax money.
Well, I'm not an expert on your part of the world, but my understanding is there is less social inequality, although I think that may be changing, and you can correct me. There's less social inequality, and you have had hitherto less of the social problems that are concerning so many of us today.
For this book, you've been asking philanthropists, charities, and those they support about what they think, how people should be encouraged to donate more, and what are the conclusions?
Well, the first thing was that the people who I've worked with over the years really urged me to do this, to write this book. You see, the rich who give are the fiercest critics of those who don't. I'd like to quote an anonymous individual, but he belongs to a family, a well-known name in Britain, and this family is given hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds. And this is what he says: what has gone wrong is any sense of responsibility. The real problem is this non-dom business. The United States has it absolutely right. If you want a US passport, you must pay US tax wherever you are. And this non-dom problem is causing such inequality and such bad feeling in Britain. Everybody should pay tax and then be given the instruments to be more charitable. We currently have a system that positively encourages tax avoidance, and we don't have a tax-efficient system that encourages people to be charitable. He says, not giving is bad for you, And that is why the rich should be bothered by not taking up the possibility of giving. Some of the rich are generating a culture in which they're despised. And if we continue to have a society that encourages unfairness and a lack of responsibility, if some of the rich fail to engage and to contribute, then we're heading for trouble. Now, that's a billionaire family speaking.
One of your arguments is that people actually, giving is quite natural for people.
All the people who know about these things and the scientists of research is that we are wired this way, that of course we need to be competitive, but we also need to be altruistic. I mean, that is how we learn to be social animals. And I'm saying giving is good for you because it makes you feel good. The scientists will tell you that those bits of your brain that make you feel great after you've eaten and even better after you've had sex will also tell you that you feel really good if you give. And all you have to do, never mind the scientists, all you have to do is ask a philanthropist.
And that was Marcus Hippie there speaking with John Nixon, author of Giving is Good for You, Why Britain Should Be Bothered and Give More.
In the next half hour of the program, we dip into the visual arts scene in Greece and find it still thriving despite the drastic austerity. But first, here's Barney Burnham with the latest world news headlines.
Thanks, Poppy. Three men arrested in connection with last week's murder of a British soldier in southeast London have been released on bail. The men, all in their 20s, were arrested on Saturday on suspicion of conspiracy to murder. Three men, including the two prime suspects arrested at the scene, remain in custody. The Syrian opposition group, the Syrian National Council, has agreed in principle to attend peace talks in Geneva planned for June, but it says it still believes the Syrian government has little intention of taking them seriously. The Colombian government and FARC rebels, who are currently engaged in lengthy peace negotiations, have reached agreement on land reform. They said the accord called for the economic and social development of rural areas and providing land to the people living there. A memorial service has been held in honour of the victims of last week's tornado in Oklahoma City, which killed 24 people and injured nearly 400 others. Several hundred French police officers have charged into about 200 demonstrators after 2 hours of street battles in Paris at the end of a major protest against gay marriage legislation. And a lesbian love story by the French director Abdelatif Kechiche has won the top prize at the 2013 Cannes Film Festival. La vie d'Adèle, chapitre 1 et 2, whose English title is Blue is the Warmest Colour, was chosen from a field of 20 films vying for the Palme d'Or. And those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. It is 8:32 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Poppy Trowbridge, and Phil Hahn.
Now, in this week's culture show, we're heading down to Brighton's Great Escape Festival to investigate the business importance and deal-making potential of these events. And we'll also hear from Monocle's very own pop photo director, Poppy Shibamoto, at the Contact Photography Festival in Toronto.
But in this preview, we're heading to Greece. After a year's hiatus, the Art Athena Fair was back last week, affirming that Greece's visual art scene is still packed with energy, even in the face of long-lasting and drastic austerity. Held in a small arena near the city's southern coastline, the art fair had fewer exhibitors than in past years, and fewer of them were from international galleries. But, amazingly, visitor numbers were sky-high throughout the four-day event, a sure sign that even if the Greeks are struggling, they're still hungry for a bit of culture. Monocle correspondent Kimberly Bradley traveled to the Greek capital to investigate what was on offer.
A music video is projected onto a bare wall at the Desta Foundation, an Athens art venue showcasing the collections of mega collector Dakis Ioannou. In the room is a column of curtains. Every few minutes, a figure appears to punch through the fabric, startling everyone. Along with a group of international guests, I'm viewing Desta's new show, curated by Greek artist-architect Andreas Angelidakis. We're here under the auspices of Art Athena, Athens' long-standing contemporary art fair. Founded in 1993 by the Hellenic Art Galleries Association, Art Athena is one of Europe's oldest art fairs. Greece in general, and Athens in particular, have always enjoyed a strong, if small, tradition of art collecting and patronage. Art Athena was long a regional art showcase and even continued through the early years of the financial crisis. But last year, the event was impossible to mount. Fair director Alexis Kanyaris explains why.
The fair didn't occur because there was no financing for the fair. You know, a fair of that scale, especially in a country in deep crisis, was something that we couldn't bridge the financing. Luckily, this year, because of some EU funding, we were able to organize that and also give it a three-year perspective, because this funding is for the next years as well. So I think it's very important that now we are starting to ensure that the fair will go on for many years.
Compared to previous years, the event is more regional. Approximately 45 booths feature mostly Greek galleries.
No, you're very right. I mean, it's true that the number of Greek galleries stayed the same. The number of international galleries was slightly reduced this year. This was done because we started market the fair on the international market last year. And last year, mind you, we didn't even have a government. So it was extremely difficult to convince anyone to invest, you know, the single euro in the Greek market, in the Greek art market. Things have improved significantly the last months. And I have the feeling that because the few galleries that took the challenge and came, foreign galleries, they were extremely happy. So they promised me to spread the message that, you know, things are moving, and that after all, Greece is not that black, you know, as it appears in the media.
Most of the gallerists here claim the sales are only moderate. But the crowds are bursting. The fair is literally packed with local visitors. Marina Fokidis, curator of the fair's symposia and parallel programs, explains why.
Art Athena in Athens, because of the lack of art institutions for so long, we didn't have a museum of contemporary art and all this, it's a very well-visited place because people, like general people, students, families, the general public, gets informed about the art world through that. So many people doesn't understand that it's exactly a commercial fair. They look at it as somewhere to go and be around art, you know? And so that's why you have this kind of crowd. I think the biggest percentage of the crowd are students, artists, families, art lovers, and all this. And this is a great support.
This program is an exploration of visual language, abstraction, disappearance, and the object.
Crowds are even coming to the symposia, which mix Greek presentations with panel discussions, including 13 well-known curators from institutions in Egypt, France, and beyond. It's part of a pointed effort to foster exchange. Soas Fokidis has curated a group show called Open Form, which integrates international galleries into the event.
This is like a group show, that's why we call it Open Form. The galleries that don't have an individual booth, each one. But what is really important is that there are galleries like Arndt from Berlin, or like Perez Projects, or like Sadie Coles, like Lehman Mopping from New York and Singapore, which are quite important in the art world. The brief they received was like, guys, help Art Athena and help Greece, support it with your name by sending us. And they send the artist in their expense. The transport is in their expense. Art Athena didn't pay for that. So it's like a mini group show. Of course, the works are on sale, but, you know, I mean, it's difficult right now to sell a work by Nedko Solakov, for example, that cost 335,000 euros right now in Greece. But Matthias Arndt was so generous to send a work like that when we asked him, because it's a diary of Nedko, calling Optimistic Series, of one year of his life into crisis. And he thought it's a very nice gesture for some Greek audiences to read this diary.
At the end of one panel discussion, an impassioned Greek listener asked why no one is interested in Greek art. The question seems strange. The VIP bus is full of international visitors who've come to take the pulse of the Greek art scene, one that might feel even more vibrant than those in more stable cities. One of the newest Athenian galleries is CAN, C-A-N, run by 30-year-old Christina Androulidaki. CAN is only 11 months old, represents mostly younger Greek artists, and is already attracting outside attention.
Our gallery is a young baby who was born at the midst of the crisis. We have no comparison. It's been great to work with young artists, and in a time that everybody is interested to see what young artists do in a country like Greece. It's been interesting in terms of subject matter, because they had so much material to work with, and commercially it has been much better than we imagined when we first opened, and there has been interest, especially from collectors from abroad. At the moment, my best collectors are from France and from Belgium.
You mentioned subject matter. Are you dealing with heavily political art?
I think the crisis has been an inspiration in general. I see all art as political. I'm not looking for a political message in a very direct way, but I think everyone who works and lives in Athens and is an artist has a radar for all the social and political changes that happen before our eyes. So, yeah, it's like a reflex.
It's a good thing for Greece that Art Athena is back, even if the global art fair circuit is shifting to a more corporate model. After all, Art Athena is running right between Frieze New York's second edition and the very first Art Basel Hong Kong. Some culture vultures feel that smaller art fairs are perhaps becoming irrelevant. Others see regional art fairs as more important than ever, a kind of indie movement to contrast with global megabrands, so to speak. For many gallerists, including Eleni Koroneou, an Athenian who's been representing Greek and international artists here for 25 years, it's about the art.
My concept is to show good art wherever you are, in Basel or in Miami or in Athens.
For Monocle, in Athens, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
And you're listening to Midori House. We'll be back after this with an update of the Italian headlines.
For many, the process of cooking is as pleasurable as the meal itself. Cue the school bell. From a Tasmanian cook who guides his guest from garden to kitchen, to a chef-led market journey in Israel, Monocle Films have hand-selected some cookery schools who focus their flavors on learning.
A wide variety of courses are available. There are two-day butchery courses, a charcuterie special session, and even one focusing on tomatoes and all the ways to use them.
Eat, cook, learn. On film, on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 8:41. That makes it 9:41 in Milan, which is where we're heading now.
Joining us on the line from Milan is our man there, Ivan Carvalho. Ivan, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House. Let's begin with some administrative elections which are happening at the moment on the local level. That's getting a lot of people talking.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, Phil. Yes, we have voting still going on today because in Italy they do 2 days of voting. So by this afternoon, the polls will close on several hundred elections in towns and cities. The biggest one is in Rome for the mayor's office. But turnout is surprisingly very, very low. It's about 20% down, as I think a lot of people are a bit tired, sort of a bit of apathy after this long, drawn-out process to get the national government formed. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the vote for mayor there in Rome.
Ivan, on that vote for mayor, is it sort of the last roll of the dice for Berlusconi? I mean, if his party doesn't win that mayoral post, does that sort of mean his party is moving away from popularity?
No, actually, it's interesting because the center-right mayor, the incumbent, Gianni Alemano, up until recently wasn't really looking like he was going to make it through probably the second round because it looks like no one's going to come out as a winner. But the Democratic Party has, which, you know, 6 months ago they had this 10-point lead in the national elections, and then everything sort of fell apart for them. The wheels came off, and now they're sort of struggling. And Alemano was, you know, a fairly easy target. I mean, his administration hasn't done a lot for Rome. There was a scandal involving, you know, patronage, classic sort of clientelism, where a lot of people from his political movement, he's affiliated with the center right, getting jobs in posts in the transportation authority, sanitation, and doing a lot of admin jobs. And basically, there were some scandals coming out that called the Parentopoli. But in the recent weeks, he's actually been able to come back a bit in the polls. And I think that's probably because the PD has really been suffering from infighting since they went to this coalition with the center-right at the national level, and they're members of their party which aren't happy with the fact that they're in alliance with Berlusconi.
I also want to ask, Ivan, the government's approval rating, Enrico Letta's government, has an approval rating of just 31%. Are these local elections being seen in a way as a sort of a referendum on his performance?
I know, it's pretty early going here because, you know, Letta's only been in power for, you know, just a few weeks. I think it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what comes out of some of these votes. In Siena, they have to vote for mayor now after the scandal with the Monte dei Paschi, the bank that's basically been affiliated with the town for so long, and it's been something where the Democratic Party has been running that city for decades. You know, Letta has had some victories, but a lot of the victories, or the victory that he had with abolishing this property tax, or at least he suspended this property tax, which is highly unpopular, which Mario Monti had to push through to balance the finances. People are saying, well, that's what Berlusconi is victory, because Berlusconi was the one pushing for that in the campaign. So Letta's saying, you know, voters, we have a bit of, there's a bit of a reprieve there. But Berlusconi, on the other hand, is saying, look, this is something that I was pushing for, so really it's my victory. In the end, they're going to have to do also public financing, end the public financing for political parties. That's going to be an interesting thing, because that's been a great rallying point for the Five Star Movement, who've been saying from the beginning that, you know, we're not going to take any public money in elections to run our campaigns. And it's going to be interesting to see how that is played out when Letta and the center-right are going to have to draw up a bill to push through an end to this, this public financing, which is something that, you know, Italian political parties have been living off for the last few decades.
It's one of the most interesting flashpoints of these elections, isn't it? Because when you think of Italian politics, you think of Silvio Berlusconi, the sort of billionaire showman, as he's called. If they end public financing for political campaigns, what future landscape lies ahead, really? Does it mean only the rich will be able to run?
Well, I think in the bill that they're going to put forward, I don't think you're going to see this. There's been talk about this already, that there's not going to be a sort of immediate cutoff. I think what you might see is a gradual easing or phasing out of public financing over maybe 2, 3, 4 years, probably. Because, for example, the center-left party, the Democratic Party, the secretary who lost the election, Pierluigi Bersani, was saying that, you know, there has to be some role of public financing, because otherwise you're going to end up in a situation with someone like Berlusconi's media empire bankrolling everything and having, you know, a dominant position. Then again, you know, the Five Star Movement, with just about €1 million of donations, have run a very, very effective campaign using the internet. Of course, they have Beppe Grillo, the comedian, who's a great rallying point, because he fills up piazzas everywhere he goes. They've done it on a shoestring budget. So while some people say, you know, it may be only for people like the rich, like Berlusconi, the Five Star Movement has shown that you can run a campaign on quite, you know, a very modest budget.
Another story, Ivan, that's getting lots of people in Italy and also I think here in the UK talking about is the future in Fiat and whether they'll actually be moving their corporate headquarters to the United Kingdom, where many are now arguing they'll pay a much lower rate of tax, something that's got a lot of people, I guess, angry on both sides.
Yeah, Fiat, you know, its operations are global. It does a lot of sales now. It actually sells as many cars in Brazil now as it does in the European market. And one of its divisions, Fiat Industrial, which is not cars, but it's actually trucks and tractors, which Fiat makes a lot of, they're set to move their residency, their tax domicile, to the UK, which has now, you know, a lower corporate tax rate than in Italy, which is about 31%. And that's, you know, this is something that you've seen recently, multinationals being slapped on the wrist by lawmakers, for example, the U.S. with Apple, how they move around money to avoid taxes. Whereas the main global headquarters, I mean, right now Fiat's a bit noncommittal about moving their actual physical headquarters from Turin, maybe to say Detroit. At this point, they're saying it's not on the agenda, but they haven't ruled out anything yet. I mean, John Elkann, the president, was saying recently that, you know, look, we're a global company. We have plants and operations, you know, in all continents almost. And it's something that, you know, there isn't the old-fashioned one headquarters. Is not something that, you know, companies can rely on anymore. A lot of people in Italy are concerned about this because, you know, Fiat is a very large private employer, and it is still today, you know, an important, you know, symbol of an Italian economy.
You know, Ivan, how are people reacting to the prospect that Fiat, this, you know, it's more than 100 years old, it's a bastion of Italian industry, might move its headquarters elsewhere? Because the situation holds a lot of irony for those in the UK who are up in arms about international companies here not paying tax, but would welcome anyone who did want to move in and pay the rate of tax that that they offer here. Are people angry? It's a lot harder to boycott a car maker than it is to boycott a coffee maker, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, Fiat in Italy, you know, in recent years, its sales have been quite sluggish. I mean, obviously, we have an economic crisis, but you know, it hasn't been coming out with a lot of, you know, new models either. So, you know, there is a bit of resentment by a lot of people. The trade unions are not happy. They've been bashing Fiat for many months on various issues. And this, again, it's something where there's a lot of chatter about this because, you know, right now Fiat is trying to push through complete a merger for Chrysler, and although they haven't, you know, they haven't spoken openly about, you know, whether or not they may be moving, you know, it's something that, you know, would be a big blow to the Italian economy if it did end up happening down the road, moving its car maker headquarters.
For now, they're just hinting at it, not confirming either way.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's talk. I mean, these companies are always looking to avoid paying, you know, the highest taxes. I mean, you saw it with Apple, Google, again, as you mentioned, you know, Starbucks and others in the UK.
Everybody's at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Ivan. We'll have to leave it there. But that was Ivan Carvello, our man in Milan.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Poppy Trowbridge. The time here in London is 8:51. We now are joined by a very important man, Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield.
Don't Good laugh, morning. Steve. That's a great introduction.
It's a nice way to introduce you on a Monday morning. Good morning, both of you. I've got the papers.
Excellent.
The British papers. We're going to be a little bit local for Britain anyway today. The big story, which all the British papers have been focusing on, obviously, for the past few days, over the weekend, indeed today as well, the events last week in Woolwich. And now we've got to the, well, what do we do next stage? And this has always been one of those things that I think political leaders have found a little bit tricky. They often don't want to be seen to be making knee-jerk reactions, but they also firstly want to show the public that they're on top of it and they can do something. But also they do look at these things and think, well, we don't want them to happen again. How do we stop them happening again? David Cameron, when he spoke after the attack, said we need to carry on living our lives as we are, which is quite different from Tony Blair after the attacks in 2005 here in London, where he said the rules of the game have changed, and listed 10 things that he said needed to be done to ensure this couldn't happen again. Of those 10 things, I don't think any of them actually became laws. But we're now in that situation where, despite Cameron's original words, his Home Secretary Theresa May is now saying, well, maybe we should, in the words of The Guardian, vow to get tough on extremist websites. In The Times, she's demanding the revival of the so-called Snoopers Charter, which is a communications bill which was going to allow the government to have, and security forces to have, access to people's emails, phone records and so on, far more so than they can. So these debates are going to go on over the coming weeks, I'm sure.
And I see you've got some photos there of a famous British couple on holiday. Now, this happens every year, doesn't
yes.
it? And it always looks so staged. Describe what you've got there in front of you, Steve.
So David Cameron and his wife Samantha are photographed in most of the papers in Ibiza. They're at a little sort of cafe table. They've both got glasses of water. I think he has. They're in the other photo in the Times. There he is with a cup of espresso. Now, you know, I mean, the photo itself, they have one opportunity for photographers to take a photo, take a pool photo. So they've got it. They can use it, and then these guys can get on with their holiday. Fine. The problem is, and this is a problem every year, it's the timing of when the holiday happens. When the riots took place in London 2 years ago, David Cameron and Samantha were in Tuscany, I think, and they didn't come home when the riots took place. And you had this bizarre situation where David Cameron was being accused of, I think he'd failed to tip a waitress at some restaurant, and that was happening while London was on fire, and then instead of coming home, he then went to see the waitress and have a photo sort of to make up with the waitress. And people in London are like, are you going to come back and sort this out? So this issue of when you go on holiday and when you don't has come up again, because obviously...
Well, this time around, he was, you know, he actually left the UK a week after the incident in Woolwich. So it's not like he was actually already on holiday. He was actually here, but he actually left.
Well, indeed. And if you know, the Sun this morning, which is not a paper we normally sort of look at their front page, but they have a very, very strong front page. The headline is Hell Hole, although hole they've spelled as in H-O-L, as in short for holiday. And the hell bit is one half of the paper, the front page, which is a picture of Lynn Rigby, the mother of Lee Rigby, going to see the site where her son was killed, and Hull is the picture of the Camerons sunning themselves. I mean, it is quite a brutal front page from the Sun there.
Steve, shouldn't he leave his Home Secretary to deal with this? I mean, we've seen Theresa May on all the political shows over the weekend. It's a bank holiday. She's clearly been working very hard. Isn't it the right thing to do, or should he be here in the background?
I think you're exactly right. And, you know, so he's gone on holiday. He's still, I mean, what they're trying to do, this government, is try to avoid what happened to the last government, where Tony Blair would go on holiday and say, I'm on holiday, John Prescott, the Deputy Prime Minister, he's in charge. And invariably, there'd be something that would go wrong when...
Snapped playing a game of croquet.
Yeah, when Blair was on holiday. Obviously, because Cameron's deputy is Nick Clegg from a different party, he doesn't really want to say, right, guys, I'm off. This guy, Nick, who actually most of you don't like, he's in charge. It'd be like the worst supply teacher ever.
But this is a serious incident. You know, this was a terrorist attack. The first time a British soldier was killed in this manner on British mainland.
Hmm.
So this is it's a very serious incident. So I don't understand why, you know, people would say it's okay for David Cameron to let Theresa May, you know, kind of manage the situation. Shouldn't he, as the leader, be here to manage the situation less than a week after this incident happened?
I think he would argue.
Control freakery, maybe. I mean, she's in charge of this. She should have the most intelligence, and she should be briefing
him.
She
should. And I think also, you know, to go back to this issue of who's in charge, he's making it very clear that he might be in Ibiza, but he's still doing his job. He's taken a lot of his staff with him. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing for the staff. It's like, hey guys, the good news is you're going to Ibiza. Bad news, it's going to be quite a lot of work. So I think, and I tend to think as well, you know, look, Britain's last Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, was famous in this country for being a workaholic, for never taking a holiday, for working ridiculous hours. That didn't really get him very far. He was tired and stressed all the time. I've got no problem with this guy having a holiday with his wife and kids. And, you know, he's got a BlackBerry and he's got a team.
And Steve, I think we have time for maybe just one more story if you want to get a quick one in.
Do we need one more? Yes. Oh, actually, yes, this one's brilliant. Right, here we are in The Independent. I love this story. Pakistani women marry in Britain's first Muslim lesbian partnership. There we are. How's that for a happy story to end on?
Progress.
Rehana Kalsour, who's 34, and Sobia Kamar, who's 29, they took their vows at a registry office in Leeds earlier this month before immediately applying for political asylum.
Great to have you, as always, Steve Bloomfield. That was Monocle's foreign editor.
And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today's program. Many thanks to our producers, Barbara Feeney and Annabelle Bly. Our researcher today was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was the very talented Toby Hammond. Up next, after the news, is Andrew Tuck with The Urbanist. I'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow with Dominic Reynolds. But from me, Phil Hahn.
And Poppy Trowbridge.
It's bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wax timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.